Hello and welcome to another episode of Twimmel Talk, the podcast where I interview interesting people doing interesting things in machine learning and artificial intelligence. I'm your host, Sam Charrington. Today we're joined by Nasreen Mostafazadeh, Senior AI Research Scientist at New York-based Elemental Cognition. Our conversation focuses on Nasreen's work in event-centric contextual modeling in language and vision, which she sees as a means of giving AI systems a bit of common sense. We discuss Nasreen's work on the story closed test, which is a reasoning framework for evaluating story understanding and generation. We explore the details of this task, including what constitutes a story and some of the challenges it presents and approaches for solving it. We also discuss how you model what a computer understands, building semantic representation algorithms, different ways to approach explainability, and multimodal extensions to her contextual modeling work. Enjoy. All right, everyone. I am on the line with Nasreen Mostafazadeh. Nasreen is a senior AI research scientist at Elemental Cognition in New York City. Nasreen, welcome to This Week in Machine Learning and AI.
Thanks, Sam. Thanks for having me.
So I hear that you started working on AI in high school. Tell us a little bit about that story.
Sure. Yeah. So I was into computer science and computer engineering in general. Like when I was a kid, you know, I basically that was the toy that I had. And I always loved the idea of doing something meaningful with it in a sense that, okay, I'm spending a lot of time in front of computer doing different stuff. What is the best thing that you can accomplish? And somehow I was introduced to the notion of programming and the fact that you can build like pieces of software that do things for you. And to me, the idea of building a piece of software that kind of automates what you do was really intriguing, which is how I got into robotics initially. So, you know, I started working on robotics with a couple of my really great friends back in high school that, you know, we ended up competing in RoboCop competitions, which is this, you know, annual worldwide competitions among different roboticists to, you know, accomplish different tasks, basically, with robots. And yeah, so the story, you know, will go forward with like how I did that for like a year and a half, and it was fantastic and we accomplished a lot. And I was always under the impression that it's actually a very complex task, right? You build these multi-agent systems that are capable of integrating their world model with like different communication within the agents and like control aspects like mechanics, imagine electronics, and all those sorts of things are really complex. And then somehow through some things that I'm not going to tell the story of today, I got introduced to the idea that natural language understanding and natural language processing as a field in general is much more complex than robotics. And that kind of blew my mind. Like, as I said, I thought I'm working on something that is, you know, super high tech, which it was, but turned out that at the time, this is like 12 years ago, there were no AI systems that could do natural language understanding at the level of a four-year-old kid. So this was an interesting challenge for me to take, which is how I kind of switched gears and started working on natural language understanding and natural language processing since then.
And so the focus of your work since then has been largely centered around this idea of event-centric contextual modeling in language and vision. What exactly mm-hmm. does that mean?
Yeah, so I think we can, you know, start with the events first, right? So I've always been interested in looking at the world basically through the lens of events, because events are such central entities of the world through which we, you know, go about our daily lives. We see things that happen as a result of some stuff that happened, which is an event. So an event can cause something else. And then our understanding of the dynamics of such events and how they shape our world on a day-to-day basis is really, you know, a crucial part of any kind of cognitive ability. And that makes, you know, me and a lot of other AI scientists very interested in modeling events. So that's the event-centric part. And then the context modeling is about, okay, I have an AI system. I want to build an AI system that can get an input and then produce some sort of an output, right? That input could be something super complex. Imagine an entire world being perceived by a situated robot. Or it could be a piece of text, right? Or it could be a piece of, you know, an input, which is multimodal. So both text and an image. So that's where what context means in my work, basically. So contextual modeling means how would the AI system deal with representing and understanding the input that is provided with. And then the language and vision part is basically where I've applied this set of, different pieces of work on event-centric contextual modeling. I am in natural language processing researcher, but I've worked on applying different, AI methodologies basically in the world of vision and language, which has become, more hot basically in the past 3 years or so.
So what are some of the types of problems that you come up with and try to solve in this context of event-centric contextual modeling?
So there are different aspects of the world that we can basically see through the lens of events, right? One major piece of work that I've done is on understanding stories, right? As you can imagine, narratives or stories are these sequence of really eventful sentences that we, have to go through on a daily basis, because as humans, we tell stories all the time, right? When we communicate, stories are a major part of how we communicate with each other. And so one of the, lines of work that I've invested on in the past couple of years has been on narrative understanding or story understanding, where you want to build AI systems that can read, a coherent sequence of sentences, which are event-centric in nature. And then it should understand it in a way that it can answer questions about it. And more so that it could also be able to generate meaningful stories. So this work, basically involves not only understanding a piece of text, which happens to be narrative, but also be able to generate, a sequence of sentences that go together coherently as a meaningful story.
And so how do you tend to approach that type of problem?
There are different things that you should take care of, right, if you want to build an AI system that can, say, understand stories. First and foremost is, okay, what is an event and a story, right? Are we talking about a novel by Shakespeare, or are we talking about like a sequence of, four words? There are, believe it or not, there are people who call sequence of five words also stories. So in my work, I've particularly, focused on understanding a sequence of five sentences stories. So these are, we call it common sense stories, in a way that we are basically interested in understanding the most like daily things that happen to anyone, in general. That's why we call it common sense. And we go about understanding them. So that's the first thing you have to address, right? What is an end story? After you address that, then you should think about, okay, now I want to build a system that can understand this kind of an input. And then it goes about different, steps that you should take. So one is, okay, how do I even represent this piece of, input, which is a narrative? So it goes, hand in hand with notions of knowledge representation. So in the AI community from decades ago, people invested a lot of time and effort on knowledge representation. And in the NLP community in particular, we have a lot of literature on semantic representation and meaning representation, right? So in my work, I'm mainly interested in extracting events, right? So what is in particular important about this story? Let's call those events and let's extract those and call it the kind of representation that I'm interested in. So that will be the second thing you do. And then the third thing is, okay, now I want to, basically connect the dots. How do I know what are the stereotypical relations that exist between these events in a story? And then that will give you this so-called narrative structure of a story that you can basically get in as an input to any other, system that wants to, say, answer questions about this story. So that's more or less, in big picture, how you would go about story modeling.
So you started out with talking about how the first thing to understand is what is a story. But it strikes me that there's also this question, you know, what do we even mean by understand when we're talking about a computer understanding a story? And there's more to it necessarily than, you know, answering questions. How do you model or assess a computer's ability to understand a story? Or is that even, you know, part of what you're trying to get at? Or is it more performance on individual tasks?
Yeah, that's a very good question, right? And I would say a fundamental question for the entire AI community. So the way we go about defining what understanding even is in the field these days is through these benchmarks that we define, right? So actually, I personally, you know, contributed to a benchmark for story understanding, which is a story close test. So the kind of benchmark we defined in particular was as follows. So the AI system is supposed to read a sequence of four sentences, which is the context of the story, basically. And then the task is to predict the ending to that story. So in the five sentences of stories that I told you, you basically imagine that you drop the last sentence, and the task for the AI system is to predict that. So I personally believe that is a good kind of a proxy for modeling whether or not a system is understanding the story that it has read. That's one way of putting it. But as it goes with many benchmarks in the AI world, whenever you have a task, and you make it into a benchmark, and then you collect a very particular, narrow, in a sense, a test set for it, it could be hacked, right? And it goes to say that maybe we shouldn't just define understanding in terms of beating a particular benchmark, but more so deploying systems in the wild. So I would say that there are different ways that you can define what true understanding even is. Having benchmarks is a good way of making, you know, having proxies, right? And having basically evaluating ourselves as we move forward. But they're not the ultimate. This should not be the ultimate end goal, I would say, of what we call true understanding. So I will go to, you know, to add that. So understanding could be through the lens of answering questions, right? So I ask the system, what is the ending to this story? And if it answers it correctly, that means it understood, right? But as it goes, that it could be hacked, meaning that without true understanding, maybe a system, a black box system, can actually specify the right ending. If we build systems that can explain themselves, that could be a win, I would say, so, which is a focus that I have at Elemental Cognition now, where we are building AI systems, in particular story understanding systems, that can explain the decisions they make, which is a better way of kind of knowing what's behind the scenes, what's, you know, under the hood for the system that is making a decision.
Before we dive into that, I want to make sure I understand the story closed test. You are training your system presumably on some corpus of five sentence stories, and then you're giving it four sentences that form some new unseen story and asking it to complete the sentence.
And it's to complete the story. Yes.
To complete the story, right. So to provide the final sentence. And in doing so, you demonstrate that it can draw out entities and contexts from the story and present them in some way that makes sense. Is it, you know, is a human grading the responses? I guess the origin of that question is, it strikes me that generally speaking, for this kind of task, you could have multiple correct output answers.
Exactly.
So how does that work?
Exactly. So that's actually what we did. We ended up collecting alternative endings, and then the AI, you know, system is posed with two alternatives. One is a wrong ending, one is the right ending, and then the task is to choose the right one. So that's actually the kind of a classification task that we ended up doing. But as you can imagine, the task could be generation, right? The agent could be just posed with the four sentences, and then the task is to generate the ending, basically open-ended, right? As opposed to multi-choice question. But yeah, for the actual story closed test, we ended up collecting the right and wrong endings by crowdsourcing. And then at the end of the day, it becomes a classification task.
In sourcing these answers, were you targeting specific mechanisms of correctness, meaning were you trying to test specific aspects of the algorithm? So for example, I forget whose work this is. Maybe I've seen it in the context of Josh Tenenbaum's work, but this, the idea that, you know, within this concept of context, there's so much that's unsaid. You know, the cup is on the table. You know, there are physical forces that, you know, keep the cup on the table. It's not going to fall unless some other force pushes it off, that kind of thing. Like, I imagine you could create sentences that kind of test that common sense context, mm-hmm. or there are other things that you can target to test with your sentences.
Right. Yeah. So there are, you know, I can imagine having stories that will, you know, kind of evaluate such cognitive abilities of a system. But the point about the story clause test is that it's about generic daily life events that happen to anyone, which is why they're called common sense. So I can give you an example. So this is an example, you know, a story clause test. So the context is as follows. Karen was assigned a roommate her first year of college. And then the story continues that her roommate asked her to go to a nearby city for a concert. And then Karen agreed happily. The show was absolutely exhilarating. And then there are two alternative endings to the story. One is Karen became good friends with her roommate. And the wrong ending, the second ending, which I gave it away, is the wrong ending, is Karen hated her roommate, right? So this is the level of complexity and generality, actually, that we are tackling for the story clause test. So it's really about a daily story that can happen to anyone. And in particular, we have crowdsourced these, as I said, by very generic prompts to the workers. So it's more about predicting the next event, which happens to be the ending to the story, yep. as opposed to the kind of phenomena that, yeah, you described.
Was the algorithm trained only on similar stories, or was it trained on other information that wasn't in that same story format?
Yeah, so we kind of set up this challenge, being the story clause test, so that people can do whatever they can to accomplish the task. So we did provide a corpus of 100,000 stories called rock stories. These are full 5-sentence stories that actually people can use kind of as positive examples. They can mine, you know, narrative structures from them. They can build like models that predict like what happens next in the story and so on. But it's not directly labeled data for the task of story clause test. And given that, we've left people, you know, free to use whatever corpora out there, whatever resources, common sense knowledge bases or modeling techniques that they have to tackle the task. So that's basically on our end. We wanted people to, you know, the research community to basically improvise and be creative and bring in their own resources. So yeah, that's about it.
What kind of engagement or uptake have you seen on this test? Have you seen any interesting approaches to building out algorithms to?
Yeah. So it happens that the reason I made story clause test in the first place is that there wasn't any, systematic way of evaluating story understanding in the field. So, you know, together with my colleagues, we made this benchmark so that we have a way of evaluating our progresses moving forward in the field. And because, as I said, there wasn't any such benchmark in place, what we made actually got a lot of attention, specifically because we showed that human does 100% on this task. So we actually made sure that the test set that we put out there is doubly human verified, so that there are no boundary cases for choosing the right versus the wrong ending. And also the best, state-of-the-art model that we tried on the benchmark was getting somewhere around like 59%. And as you can imagine, random baseline would do 50%, human was doing 100%. So there was like more than 40% gap between the best system results and the human performance. So, you know, these two characteristics, I would say, really contributed to the task getting a lot of attention. And, you know, since then, this was released about 2 years ago, a lot of teams, different teams, you know, from academia and industry have tackled the task. There has been so many results. But I go back to the point that I made about hacking, right? So after we released this data set for many months, maybe, 8, 9 months, 10 months, there wasn't any significant improvement. And then we made it into a shared task, meaning that, you know, we had a challenge and this workshop and there was a prize, right, for the winner up. And then whenever you do that, there are different approaches that will come at you, which is actually very healthy for a benchmark so that you know exactly what works and what doesn't. And in that, challenge that we ran, basically, that challenge day, there was a team submission from UW that had found out that actually without reading the context, which is the whole point about this natural language understanding framework, without reading the context, you can leverage some, stylistic features isolated in the endings, just alone that, to find the right ending. And the interesting fact about this group is that, the guy that actually contributed to this model used to work on detecting the fake Yelp reviews and like detecting notions such as like age or gender from a piece of text. And it happened that turns out our wrong endings actually, without our knowledge, our wrong endings had similar features as with like fake reviews. So they had made this, kind of a very interesting, observation, and they had leveraged that and turned out that you could do, really much better if you just train a classifier that just detects the such features. So that was a very interesting outcome of that challenge that we ran. And still, there was still a huge gap between human performance and their performance, which was around 72, I think, or 76%. But it still was such a good example of what can go wrong when you collect data, right? For a narrow task, as I said, in AI. And this isn't something that has happened only to story close tests. Like other benchmarks in the field, such as natural language inference, NLI, or VQA, visual question answering, have basically showcased similar patterns that when we go about collecting data sets for testing purposes, they could be really biased. And often those biases are not even revealed to us. If we are lucky, we will catch some of them, but often they're not revealed. And then, we can go forward without knowing them and then patting ourselves on the shoulder that we are doing, deep language understanding and claim victory that we are surpassing, things like human performance. But the truth is that narrow benchmarks are narrow in the sense that they don't really represent the world, and we should be really careful with the way that we collect our data.
Right.
And I will add this, that we were careful actually with the way we collected the story close tests, and still there were biases that there was no way we would have known ahead of time. So it again goes about saying how much more care as a community, as a research community, we should give to exploring, different ways of collecting data and vetting them. And then, as I said, more so, I believe in the power of testing your systems on multiple frameworks and making sure that they scale beyond the particular training data that they're trained on or overfitted on, basically.
You created this benchmark. Have you also participated on the other side of it, building out models to try to improve on the state of the art?
Yeah. So when I worked on this, we had many different systems, as I said, but they were none of them were doing fantastically. They were basically capped at 60-some%. And then actually the most recent thing that we did after realizing that with the, new results that were particularly shared in the challenge day was to come up with another data set so that these hidden biases are kind of, taken care of. And so now, the research team that I'm working on right now at Elemental Cognition, we are working on different kinds of stories that are not exactly rocket stories, but technically, you can test and, evaluate our system on rocket stories as well. But it's just a more challenging task that we are tackling right now than the story close test.
Tell me about the types of approaches that you would take for, either of these types of tasks. I guess when I hear semantic representation, the first thing that I think of from a deep learning perspective is like embeddings. Mm-hmm. Does that come into play? Are there other, what are the kinds of techniques that come into play?
Yeah, I will tell you about the best model that we had, which was doing, 59% when we released the data set, basically. So that was a model that was basically, imagine a sentence embedding model. All it did was that you want to build a model that embeds the context, which is four sentences, in the shared semantic space with the right ending. So basically, we train these two parallel neural nets, one of which will embed the context, one of which will embed the ending. And at the end of the day, you wanted the encoding of the right ending to be closer to the context than the wrong ending. So this was called DSSM, a deep semantic structure model that did like the best within the multiple models that we had initially tried for this story close test. And then actually, I will go about saying that the current state of the art as about released data points about a month ago was from OpenAI, where they have this nice piece of work that is transformers that are also pre-trained on a large language model that are doing actually really a good job, 86% on the story close test. So that goes about telling you that there are a lot of regularities that you can leverage by just reading a lot of corpora out there and building a language model. So that's sort of not exactly what I would have predicted in terms of what would be the best model that can tackle story understanding. But the recent results show that actually a very strong language model can do a good job in predicting the ending.
With the language model that they trained, was it trained specifically for this task, or was it trained generally, like training an embedding space generally?
Yeah, so the interesting thing about that work actually was that, which kind of makes it, sets it apart from the other systems that have been submitted on our story close test benchmark, was that it was actually a generic language model. It was this very big language model that is pre-trained and then tuned for our particular story close test. So story close test comes with a validation and a test set. So validation is what people usually use for tuning purposes. But the nice, as I said, the nice characteristic of OpenAI system was that it was a, pre-trained generic language model. That is actually, I will add this, that I told you that we are working on releasing a new story close test version. A new version of the data set that kind of bypasses and helps with, improving the kind of biases that people had found out about the data set. And we tested the OpenAI system, and it was the only system that was still having a very high performance on the new data set, which goes about saying that turns out the other, submitted systems were actually leveraging the biases as opposed to doing true language understanding.
Is there a way to characterize whether the OpenAI system is just better at leveraging biases, as opposed to true understanding?
That's a very good point. And I do think that there's no way for us whether or not there are some hidden biases in any of the data sets that we are benchmarking our progress on. And until we get to a point that we can really deploy a system in the wild and see that they can basically model different kind of complex inputs and then generate different kinds of complex outputs, there's no way of guaranteeing that, right? I'm sure that our new data set that we are about to release also has new biases that we are not aware of, right? And there's a very good chance that the OpenAI system, as an example, is just doing a better job at, memorizing different sorts of irregularities that are hidden. So I think there's just really no way of knowing that. But I guess as long as at least we have better practices in place for, testing and evaluating our systems on a variety of benchmarks, we are in a better shape.
One of the points you raised earlier was the idea of systems that can explain themselves. Now, that can mean a lot of different things, but one of the things that it can mean is that a system like this OpenAI system or some other system with this capability can describe, why it is producing the sentence that it's producing, or choosing the sentence that it's choosing. Is that, when you say explain, is that the
the focus of your work?
Yeah, exactly. So as I said, the outcome of the challenge that we ran on the Story Close Test was kind of an eye-opening for me personally to think beyond like classification tasks. And, you know, with a few of my colleagues, we had a lot of back and forth. And the consensus was that if we build AI systems that not only choose the right, whatever their, you know, space they're provided with, choose the right ending in the context of Story Close Test, but also explain why they did that so that we can basically probe them. We can see whether or not their decision makes sense. Because as I said, for instance, in the case of the team, that the UDub team that was leveraging the features, the you know, stylistic features, the system can't explain that I chose this because it had more number of adjectives versus adverbs, or it had like, I don't know, like 8 words as opposed to 5, right? It should say something that is logically sound to a human reader. So that's, yeah, back to your point, that's exactly what I mean by explanation. And I do think that explanation is this cognitive ability that as humans we have, and working on the next generation of AI systems that can explain themselves is not really only for the sake of, say, evaluation or for the sake of, I don't know, like there are now these regulations in, say, EU that push for AI systems not to be black boxes, but it's really about modeling this human capability and this cognitive ability that we have as humans, because explaining is a way that we showcase our intelligence often, and we have to have AI systems that can just portray that.
And so there are different ways of approaching that. Some take the explanations from an intrinsic perspective and try to introspect on the actual model that's doing the deciding and put what it sees there into words, and others take more of an external perspective and try to apply some other model to the primary model to generate explanations.
Mm-hmm.
How does your work in this space approach that distinction?
Yeah, so I personally, this is my personal view. I personally, first and foremost, I believe that the explanation should be in natural language form, right? So there are different pieces of work, a lot also in the vision and language community, that they basically count your attention features as the way of explaining why a system, you know, say chooses a particular, you know, outcome versus another. But I count natural language explanations as a reasonable way of interfacing with human. So back to your question about there being two disjoint modules, that will, one of which will do the prediction, let's say, one of which will do the generation. I would say that I'm not against either of those. It could be a disjoint model, it could be a joint model. But as long as system can actually somehow provide the explanation that makes sense to the human that is judging whether or not it makes sense, it could be still useful. So there are different ways of looking at explanation, right? Is it for basically trying to diagnose like why a system makes a particular decision? Is it for improving the system? Is it what is the purpose, right? And I would say that at the end of the day, as long as the system can improve, for instance, through the interaction it has with human for explaining themselves itself, why do we care if there are two different modules, that one of which is generating the explanation and one of which is doing the prediction? But at the end of the day, as I said, I think we can take explanation as a way of knowing whether or not the system can tell us what's going under the hood. And if a system chooses to have two different modules, that's just basically an implementation decision. But I can't imagine a successful system that doesn't have those two modules communicate with each other. So again, but I'm not opposed to the idea.
So thus far, we've talked primarily about natural language understanding aspects of contextual modeling, but you recently presented at CVPR on some multimodal work incorporating both language and vision. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure, absolutely. So as I said, the work on event-centric contextual modeling has different applications. So we talked about story understanding. Another application of it for my work has been on language and vision. So the language and vision community has seen a lot of interest, has received a lot of interest in the past like couple of years, basically after, deep learning growth. Which is because, we can just basically have better ways of encoding images, which is very, nicely something that you can nicely feed into a recurrent model that with which you can generate language. So that's more so what my work has been around as well. So image captioning has been the most popular application in vision and language since the beginning, which is about how would you build an AI system that will caption in a given image very literally. So how would you literally describe what you see in a photo? So my work has been mainly focused on going beyond literal description and getting more so towards a kind of vision and language task that require some degree of common sense reasoning. So to give you an example, the very first work I started on vision and language was about this static image. Imagine, I'm just, describing it basically now. Imagine this static photo you see of two policemen with a fallen motorcycle on the ground. And as human beings, when we see this, right, the three static objects, right, two policemen and a fallen motorcycle, from these three static objects, we go beyond, we connect the dots and we infer that, oh, there should be a notion of injury, or, oh, there should have been a motorcyclist, right? Or, oh, like there should have been an accident here. So these kind of connections that we make are really interesting, and it wasn't something that was already explored in the research community. So we basically defined this task called visual question generation, that what it does is it focuses on building an AI system that, given a static image that happens to be event-centric, meaning that something's happening in the image, what is the most natural first question that pops to your mind given that image? So that's basically the VQG work that I did that started off a series of other vision and language projects that I worked on. And, I will go about asking you, so what would be the most natural question that you would ask given the image that I just described to you?
At the highest levels, like, what happened?
Yeah, what happened? Exactly. So we understand that something should have gone wrong or should have occurred that, caused that scene. Yeah, what happened? Is the motorcyclist alive? How, like, serious was the injury? Stuff like that are the most common things that people ask. And it was the kind of, task that we wanted to push for to go beyond literal description.
And so how do you go about tackling that?
Yeah, so we basically built it. First and foremost, you need data, right? So we collected our own data set called VQG, which was on more so on event-centric images. We queried like Bing search engine to get images that have something happening in them, say fire, earthquake, injury, stuff like that, or an accident. And then using that data, we built this model that gets as an input the feature vector of an image, which could be a convolution or neural net. And then given that, just train a language model, basically a conditional language model that will just generate the text description, which is happens to be a question here. So we actually leveraged existing image captioning models and just basically tuned them and retrained them on our own data. And it was, semi-successful in asking relevant questions given an eventful image.
And so with the data set you curated, you had these images of events, things that happened, and then you had a single caption for each image?
Our data actually comes with five questions per given image, but it could have been anything, right? It just happens that ours was five, just for the training purposes. We collected 15,000 of such images, each paired with five questions.
And is the task structured in such a way that it's classification or generation of a new sentence based on?
That's a very good question. It is generation here. And as it goes with any generation task, you have the problem of, okay, how would you even evaluate, which is a major, you know, problem in the community. So here we just, you know, try different metrics that are classically used in the visual language community. There are different methods. You know, you can use Blue, you can use Meteor. We just use Delta Blue, which happened to correlate the best with the human judgment.
So can you elaborate on that? What is Delta Blue? What are the inputs to that?
Of course. So these are metrics, right? There's no, like, it's not no AI, like nothing is being trained. It's just a metric for evaluating a generated output versus some gold standards, which is an inherent problem because for so many tasks, there's no limited set of possible, you know, gold answers. As it goes for this, right, there's so many different questions you can ask given an image. But at the end of the day, you know, as in research community, at least what you have to resort to is to define a set of predefined, you know, limited set of predefined questions here.
Even there are so many ways to ask the same question, let alone
different
types of questions that you could ask for about a situation.
Exactly, which goes to saying that to what I just said, that it's just inherently problematic. I would say that we don't know how to evaluate language generation, which is not machine translation. So in machine translation, although in machine translation, Blue, which is this metric of how would you evaluate how good of a job you've done at translation, there even people use Blue, which you know, there are different pieces of work that show that even that doesn't correlate with human judgment that strongly. But even in machine translation, the task is much more defined, right? The semantic content of the source language is really close to the semantic content of the you know, the language that you're going to, whereas in dialogue or in story generation or in this vision and language test that I just talked about, nothing is set predefined. So we have this major problem, which goes back to the story I was telling you for the story close test, that we decided to go with the classification task because generation inherently is hard to evaluate and classification gives us this ability to systematically evaluate. With the language and vision work that I told you about, we ended up using Delta Blue, which is this metric for basically counting the number of words that occur in the generated output versus the gold few human authored questions that you have in hand.
So you generate a question based on the image and you're evaluating the performance of, or you're evaluating that question based on Delta Blue, and presumably you're crowdsourcing the gold standard answers?
Exactly. Yes. It just comes from the data set, right? So the 15,000 data, you know, points that we collected, we set aside a portion of that for test where that Delta Blue, human authored gold questions come from.
And so for your implementation of a system to do this, what was the general approach you took?
The general approach, as I said, was this model that encodes the image using a convolutional neural net and then generates
I did say that. Yeah.
No worries. And then generates a sequence of words using a recurrent neural net. And these are, you know, there's this recurrent neural net language models are really strong in generating grammatical outputs, meaning local coherency. But they're not really good at capturing intricacies and generating basically contentful sentences. As you may have seen, you know, if you look at the kind of language that chatbots generate or a lot of such vision and language pieces of work, often the generations are bland, meaning that they're, you know, they're usually safer side. Mm-hmm. They don't have a lot of contentful words or events or stuff like that. But they do a really good job in generating coherent sentences.
And did your work try to address that?
Yeah, so there are different. So we did try different things. Just the question is, okay, I have this system that generates different kinds of output. People usually have this NBES list that they re-rank. So basically, when you are generating, at the end of the day, you can have a search, right? And then the question is how to do that search better so that you hit the ones that are more contentful. So there are like different little tricks in the paper we had for the VQG work, visual question generation that I just told you about. We had this very simple heuristic that if in your NBES list you have a sentence that has verbs in it, give it a higher rank. Or if you have a longer sentence, it's most possibly a better sentence. And then you put all these different features together, and then you tune your model. You use MERT, but there are different kind of rankers you can use out there. But it's not a solve. It's a serious problem we have for the basically these kind of recurrent neural net generations.
And when you described this earlier, I think you described it as a conditional language model. Is that right?
So you have to have a way of conditioning on the input, right? Here, the input is the image. The input could have been anything, right? In the case of story generation, the input could be the previous sentence. Here, we want to generate using the image. So we condition the generation of the language on the feature vector of the image.
I'm trying to visualize what that looks like or how that is implemented. When I think about RNNs and time steps and all that kind of stuff, where does the feature vector of the image come into play? Or is that the input at these time steps?
Yeah. So the very last model we tried for the VQG task, actually, what it got as the input was the FC7 feature of the, like in the convolutional neural net, one of slices that you can get is like FC7. So this fully connected layer is what we fed into the RNN as the just for the very first step. You can actually feed that in for all the steps. That's something we tried. We just got worse results. We just conditioned the very first time step on that. But as I said, that's a decision that you can make by just trial and error.
Awesome. We have covered a ton of ground. Are there any other things that you might want to mention about your current research areas?
I think we covered a lot. I think that what I would conclude this today's time with is to just mention that I've chosen to work on the topics in AI that I found to be really challenging in terms of the amount of work that still is needed to be done to even, scratch the surface. So common sense reasoning happens to be one of them. There's a consensus in the field these days that we yet don't have an AI system that can even have the common sense understanding of a, 4 or 5 year old kid, let alone an actual human like adult. And I think that the kinds of work on like story understanding, story generation, or the vision and language tasks that are event centric go about, at least going one step beyond the existing efforts for doing something that is a little bit more challenging. And I think it's important to be mindful of how far we've come, which is to tackle a lot of previously challenging, kind of perception tasks. But we really have a long way going forward doing more of a reasoning and cognitive tasks, which is my personal research interest. And I think a lot more people in the community should pay attention to it.
Well, Nasrin, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
All right, everyone, that's our show for today. For more information on Nasrin or any of the topics covered in this episode, visit twimmelai.com/talk/174. If you're a fan of the podcast, please pop open your Apple or Google podcast app and leave us a 5-star rating and review. Your ratings are a great way to help new listeners find the show. As always, thanks so much for listening and catch you next time.